For thousands of years, civilization has been a destructive force both ecologically and socially. In the midst of the sixth extinction, the future of humanity and our other than human kin hangs by a thread. At this pivotal moment in time, we must reach back into the depths of the human story and uncover our mistakes. There is still time to reconnect with what we have lost, to restore our broken relationship to the land where we dwell, and to remember the human place in the wild. Hello, and welcome to the Rewilding Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Michael Bauer. This podcast is produced and made possible from supporters on Patreon. Thank you. If the Rewilding Podcast inspires you, gives you hope, or makes you think, please subscribe, share it on social media, and become a patron at patreon.com/PeterMichaelBauer. If you're new to Rewilding or want to expand your perception of it, I recommend attending one of my Rewilding 101 workshops, which I offer both in person in Portland, Oregon, and online for those who live around the world via Zoom. You can check upcoming dates and register at rewildportland.com. To attain the level of resilience that cultural rewilding calls for requires moving away from an economy based on extraction for profit that lays waste to local ecosystems and destroys ancient ways that people have lived from the land. To move away, we need alternatives and examples of how other people found and maintained sustainability. How have humans lived in a myriad of ways for millennia without destroying their land and not living in greatly unequal societies? What is the subsistence economy and what makes them so resilient? To talk with me about this today is Dr. Helga Virich. Dr. Virich was born in Bremen, West Germany, and immigrated with her parents to Canada, growing up in North Bay, Ontario. She began her studies at the University of Toronto in 1969. From 1977 to 1980, as part of her research, she lived in the Kalahari among hunter-gatherers in the Quinang District with Richard B. Lee supervising. During this time, she worked as a consultant on the effects of the extreme drought in Botswana. She was awarded her PhD by the University of Toronto in 1981 and went to work as a principal scientist at the West African Economics Research Program, International Crops Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics, headquartered in Hyderabad, India. She worked as a visiting professor of anthropology at the University of Kentucky from 1985 to 1987, then as an adjunct professor of anthropology at the University of Alberta from 1989 to 1997. From 1999 to 2022, she worked as an instructor at the Yellowhead Tribal College in Alberta. Now retired, she spends her time on a rural farm with her husband. Dr. Virich, thank you for coming on to the Rewilding Podcast.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention, I'm also a research fellow of the Early Southern Sapiens Center in Bergen, Norway.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
These are the people who are doing all of these extraordinary digs in Southern Africa. Some of these sites go back 80,000 years, you know, and the implications for human evolution of studying ecological interactions between human populations and their ecosystem, their environment, are enormous.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, I sometimes think we get very lost in the minutia of the modern world, and we forget what kind of species we are.
I agree. Yeah.
An enormous literature coming out in ecology on something called flows.
On something called what?
Trophic flows. It's in ecosystem studies. Robert Payne is one of the founders of this. He is the originator of the term keystone species. Okay. And if you see the recent films and papers on what happened when a couple of small packs of wolves were restored to Yellowstone Park, that gives you an idea of what a keystone species might be. It's a creature that has numerous sort of cascading effects in the ecosystem, affecting other species, but also affecting the hydrology and everything else. There's a little short film on YouTube called How Wolves Change Rivers, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, I've
Another,
seen that one actually. It's really awesome.
yeah, another keystone species, which is very relevant to the human case, actually, is the beaver. Okay, when beavers are introduced into an area, they can alter the entire ecosystem because they change the hydrology. They slow down the movement of water downstreams and so on. Okay. And so I began to kind of work on an idea based on my own research that perhaps humans actually evolved as a keystone ecologically engineering species. Unfortunately, with civilization, as we like to call it, we have, in a sense, departed from that role, and we've become ecologically quite destructive. Okay. And when I was working in Botswana, before I did that drought survey at the end of my time there, what really struck me was two things, very, very prominent impressions. One, and the main one, was that the hunter-gatherers were doing fire ecology to prevent wildfires. Okay, they were deliberately doing these long, slender burns, producing fire breaks as the dry season advanced, because as the beginning of the rainy season began, there would be these thunderstorms and lightning strikes. And if they didn't do that, there was a danger of extreme wildfire damage. The one man, I'll never forget him saying this, he said, "A tree could even die." Just like that. Like among these people, it was almost sacrilege to cut down a living tree. Now think about that, what that means, okay? And then the other thing I discovered was that they, because of the sort of temporary camping sites that they had, okay, they would stay maybe 4 to 6 weeks at the most in most of the cases I documented, and they would bring an enormous amount of what they called wild food, you know, berries, nuts, roots, fruit of various kinds, back and distributed among the households, maybe 4 to 6 households in that camping site. Now the result of, and of course, you know, if there was any hunted meat, it was returned there and distributed as well. And of course, they would have latrine areas outside the camp. All right. As a result of all of this, there was a much higher level of you know, local vegetation regrowth in the previous camping sites. You know, when I went gathering with the women, we would detour on our way back. We would detour to old sites that had been abandoned for 30, 40, 50 years, and they would just be chock full of all kinds of bushes and trees and smaller undergrowth that was food, you know, producing food of various kinds. So just by their activities, they were, one, reducing the disastrous wildfires, which I guess must have been the case in the past before humans started doing something about it, particularly in the dry season in southern Africa. And secondly, they were increasing the distribution and environmental hotspots of, and producing higher environmental hotspots of species that were not just favored by people, but that produced food for birds and other animals as well. And recently, I actually came across a very interesting paper showing that in the Serengeti environment in East Africa, that the temporary camps of pastoralists, in other words, livestock, nomadic livestock keepers like the Maasai and so on, they did the same thing. These temporary camps became hotspots of ecological diversity of food plants and therefore also of animal species that would be attracted to them. All right. Now, when you consider that on the whole, this didn't just involve contemplation of short-term effects, right? They knew full well the consequences of longer term, first of all, neglecting those fire breaks. They knew that that would be disastrous. They knew that in the long term, an old camping site would become an ecological hotspot. And that's one of the reasons why they never reused camping. Okay. But they also knew other things, you know, and it's incorporated into their culture that there are other species within the environment, species of animals and plants, which are equally vital to the maintenance of high diversity and productivity in that environment. I don't know when you did your reading of what I had written about. Did you come across the example of the acacia and the giraffe?
Why don't you explain it?
Okay. Well, there is a film. Before I left for the field, I saw this film by a man called John Marshall, who is the son of Lorna Marshall and her husband, some of the very first people to do anthropological reporting from the Kalahari. And in this film that he showed, it had a group of, you know, hunter-gatherers, not the ones I was with, but these are about 800 miles to the northwest of where I was. But anyway, they were hunting a giraffe, all right? So I naively expected to see people in you know, hunter-gatherer people in the southeast Kalahari where I was hunting giraffes. There were certainly plenty of giraffe around, but they didn't. And I started asking about this, and you know, they mumbled something, and then they said, if you want to know why we don't, it's not, I mean, if a giraffe offers itself, that's one thing, but we don't target giraffe. And I had all kinds of, you know, sort of obvious ideas going through my mind, like the arrow poison isn't strong enough to, you know, bring a giraffe down, and it's an impractical amount of meat, and a whole bunch of other ideas. Well, so I finally found the source of this prohibition against hunting giraffe. It was an old lady. She was a granny. She was, you know, mining her grandchildren in a camp. All the other people were away hunting and gathering, I guess. So she was quite happy to see me and talk about this. She's delighted. And giraffe apparently had fascinated her from the time she was a little girl. And she collected all kinds of wisdom and stories and everything else about them. And I said, so, you know, tell me why do you believe that hunting a giraffe is a bad idea? And she said, oh, because the giraffe is the midwife of the acacia. The acacia, you know, these tall fan-shaped trees that you see all through the sort of plains area in Africa. And I sort of wrote it down, and I thought, well, okay. And then she explained. She said that the giraffe, she phrased it so that she thought I could understand. She said God made the giraffe tall enough that a giraffe can reach the leaves and the seed pods of the acacia tree. And when the giraffe leaves and deposits these seeds in its dung, the young tree can grow up. And therefore, the giraffe, in a sense, assists the birth of new acacia trees. And this is, you know, this is its role. And that's why giraffes shouldn't be hunted, because we need these trees. And I didn't think anything more about it until years later when I was doing more research, and I happened to across an article. This was actually research that I did for the Green Revolution Institute, ICRISET, that I was working for. I was getting information on what are called nitrogen fixing species of plants. You know, beans. Why are beans and peas and things like that a useful crop to regenerate the fertility of a soil, right? And I discovered that acacia trees and many related species like that are nitrogen fixing. You know, they have a symbiosis with a type of bacteria in their root nodules. And so they actually increase the fertility of any soil that they're planted in. Well, the Kalahari is a sand desert. It's not a very fertile place, at least not initially, right? It's not good for agriculture. But if you think about it, the acacia, groves of acacia that you find all over the place are what make it green, because they provide the nitrogen for the soil so that other plants can grow. And there's another one. There's actually a vine called the marama, which is, you know, one of the main food sources. It's also got a kind of a bean-like pod, and the marama nuts are a major food source for the hunter-gatherers. And that's something else. When I went gathering with the women, what I found was quite extraordinary. Occasionally, they'd dig something out of their backpack, a handful of marama, you know, nuts, if you want to call them beans, if you like, or some, you know, some of the berries and so on that we picked off bushes, and they'd scatter them on the ground as we were walking, heel them into the ground, and I said, "What are you doing? We just spent half an hour collecting these." And they said, "Oh, no matter, but it's important to give something back to the mother." Okay, and their perception of whatever mother or, you know, Gaia, whatever you want to call it, is that, you know, it's just like cutting down a living tree. The idea that the whole ecosystem represents a living web and that you can't easily remove or damage parts of it, but you have to nurture it and look after it and help plants reproduce and all this kind of stuff. This was very prominent in their culture. It got to the point where, you know, sometimes I'd wonder, you know, two guys would walk off with all their hunting equipment and everything else. And later on, as you know, I was gathering with the women, and there is a kind of sexual division of labor, but it's not strict. Sometimes it's one way or the other. But anyway, we'd see these guys, and they weren't hunting. What they were doing was that producing those fire breaks. I think the men actually spent more time in the dry season preventing wildfires than they spent hunting. Hunting was
Interesting.
secondary to that, okay? And so in a way, I began to see these territories where, you know, they would have camping parties in the middle of a named territory, which is maybe 5 to 10 miles across, you know, kind of a named area. They weren't like defended territories of owned land. No, they were administrative districts. And people who camped together had jobs to do, maintain the ecosystem in that district. And, you know, that's not the way most people think of hunter-gatherers. At least not that I know of. They tend to think of hunter-gatherers as just living in the wild, right? Well, one man actually told me, he said, "There's no wild. This everything is tamed to us." And this also included the animals, by the way. People talk about wild animals. He's, you know what he told me? He said, "Only frightened animals are wild," meaning dangerous. Dangerous or inclined to just run the minute they see you. Only frightened animals. And these animals weren't frightened. That's the other thing that really shocked me. in a way. We would pass herds of, impala and Thompson's gazelle and wildebeest and hartebeest and, giraffe and stuff like this. Even lions lying under a tree sleeping. I'd be walking along with the women thinking, oh boy, what are we going to do? And nobody reacted. I mean, the lions would kind of look up and go, oh, it's just them, and go back to sleep. The animals, I mean, if you walk directly towards an animal, yeah, they'd react because they, don't know why are you doing this. But all these herds of what I was thinking of as wild game, for the hunter to hunt, were reacting very, very unconcernedly. They were no more nervous of us passing by than the cattle at the cattle post, 25 miles away. And the more I thought about this, the more curious I got, because it just didn't seem to fit. What is wilderness? What are wild animals? What are wild plants? What do we call wild? Where did that word even originate? Okay, and I'll tell you where it originated. It originated with civilization, where wild was considered anything that's up for grabs. You just go out and get it because nobody owns it. And then the upper classes would have estates where they had herds of deer and wild grouse or whatever, and they'd have shooting parties and stuff, but they owned it, right? It's not the same. To see the whole world as wilderness, meaning outside of human control, is false.
Totally.
Anyway, so I don't know if that, I was curious after I wrote up my thesis, because of course it was really difficult when I wrote up my thesis, because the situation was such. The Botswana government, when I arrived, had just passed a law against what they called veld burning. In other words, setting fire to the landscape would be met with huge fines and even prison sentences. Okay. So I had to focus on something else for my reports to the government on my research and, for my thesis, because my thesis, the part of the agreement for research permit, is your thesis goes back to their archives. And God forbid anybody in the government should read what I was finding out about the fire ecology and all the rest of it. So I couldn't write about that. Okay. I had to wait. Now it's almost 35, 40 years since I was there longer. I'm getting pretty old, so. But the thing is, now I think it's time to speak out, because the punishment of Indigenous people for their management of so-called wild ecosystems has been so destructive. Colonial period onward, even when it's not deliberately so, like with the killing of all the buffalo on the plains and all.
Totally.
It's the main cause. The commercialization, at motive, logging companies going out and clear cutting, and people wanting to kill all the predators so that there's more deer to hunt. All these mistaken ideas about how the ecosystem works has done huge amount of damage. And the range of issues that are going to have to be tackled to reverse that is humongous.
Oh, yeah.
It's scary.
Yeah.
To give just one example, there are attempts to restore bison, buffalo, in North America, right? And it's ongoing. I spoke with the guy who used to manage the Elk Island Park, east of here, east of Edmonton. And that's where some of the last of the bison were being, safeguarded. It's also one of the last places where the bison have not picked up, brucellosis and other kind
Mm-hmm.
of cattle diseases. And he He's tried, Mr. Olson, he's tried for years to, expand the range of these animals, encouraged them to, some of them to be brought to Banff and other national parks, but also on native land, Indian land in Alberta and elsewhere. And there's a huge project now in southern Saskatchewan to do the same. And he points out, for instance, that the bison, first of all, because they are not treated with all these antibiotics and things that cattle are, that they actually spread beneficial bacteria through their dung, throughout the area where they're grazing, one. Secondly, they eat slightly different varieties of things. They'll eat wild plants that the seeds pass through them and spread, the sort of normal kind of range of plants from the prairie ecosystem. Okay. And their grazing patterns also do this because they don't overgraze voluntarily. And then finally, there's the fact that their fur, they shed copious amounts of fur from the fronts of their bodies. And apparently, this is used by the ground nesting birds on the prairie to line their nests. And so they have a higher reproductive success because they'd start nesting quite early in the spring. And there are often very severe frosts, even freezing periods.
Amazing.
So, everything from eagles to ptarmigans survive better if they share the environment with bison.
It's really cool seeing the, hearing about and seeing the complexity of how these different organisms survive together and thrive together. I'm curious if you can define the term subsistence economy.
Well, it's simple in a way. It means that you subside, your subsistence, your food, your shelter, your the means of your, shelter and feeding yourself and clothing yourself and everything else that you need is from a fairly localized area that you live within. Okay. I suppose one could argue that civilization subsides on the planet, but that's away from, the whole meaning of that. It means that, you're at a subsistence level. You're not collecting more than you need to survive in your environment. Okay. And that's different, very different from what most what we call civilizations do, because they support larger urban assemblages, okay, of people, and to house and feed those people involves removing things from further afield that can be brought into the city to provide for them. And usually, what that means is that somebody is trying to make a living from being a trader or a provider, as opposed to living just to feed themselves. Okay, and so if you're, if you're trying to do that, and the population in the city is growing, you might in fact wind up denuding much of the forest in your surrounding area and having to go further and further afield, right? You might wind up overgrazing the surrounding area in order to produce enough meat for the city, right? I mean, if you look at the very first written text from the Middle East that we have a record of, the Epic of Gilgamesh, I think it's called, right? Well, that is essentially describes how a prince from I think the city of Ur, I think it was called Gilgamesh, went out and, in the symbolic sense of a poem like that, went out and killed the hunter-gatherers who were trying to protect the last forests, and then denuded. I mean, the cedar and oak forests of the Middle East are just little tiny remnants now. right? And it's always seen as such a heroic story, but it's not heroic. It's a horrendous story.
Did you hear about when they were ISIS was destroying all these artifacts in Iraq, and so these museums were trying to sneak out all these different things, and they found two ancient tablets that were part of the original story of Gilgamesh that rejected, that was God rejecting his offering of the cedar trees, essentially like an ecological message that up that turned around the whole story, saying that actually this was a bad idea.
Because when the forests go, rainfall is affected. One of the reasons, in a sense, I think I was ultimately unpopular for a while, anyways, when I was at ICRISAT at this, International Green Revolution Institute, is because when I worked with the agronomists there, we discovered, we went, a lot of the land in the world is sloping, as you know, because of rivers and streams, right? So we went in the in this is in Burkina Faso, in each of our study villages, there was a different level of what we call development, okay? Commercialization, basically. All right, so we compared the villages with more commercial production that were seen as entrepreneurial and big success stories versus the ones that were kind of still traditional and everything else. And of course, the big difference between them was the amount of tree cover, you know, because the treed commons was eaten up. As soon as you get permanent cultivation with chemical agriculture, you don't have to do secondary growth to let it come back. You don't need a big commons to do that in. And certain people, a minority actually in each village, were you know, they got the message that they could make lots of money if they produced cotton as well as food. So they went from a subsistence to a more commercial extractive economy, and they ate up a lot of the commons. So the forest, the amount of forest land in these villages was a lot less. All right. So what we did is we were wondering about the effect on water tables. Okay. It's kind of logical, right? So we dug test pits from the top to the bottom towards where the stream or river or lake was in all of these villages. And what we found was that the villages with the most deforestation in those villages, the water table had sunk alarmingly. In the top, in one village, we couldn't even find the water table. I mean, we must have dug down like 5 feet or something. Just no, it wasn't even moist. And the trees that remained in that village, some of them were actually dying, you know. Because there was a drought towards the end of the time I was there. And of course, if there's a drought and it rain doesn't fall at all, you know, then the water table sinks even more, right? Whereas the villages with less deforestation still had a water table that you could find. Even further down, you know, further up the slope, there was a water table that roots from these trees could reach, okay? And also bushes and things like that. And of course, people had dug wells in, you know, the upper slopes as well, because often the village is located sort of overviewing the river valley, right? And what we were finding was that in the dry seasons with deforestation, the wells were, of course, running dry because they were dug down to the water table, right? And they couldn't find it wasn't there. So they were having to bring water up from the lower slopes. Then, when the rain started, the soil had become more compacted with more irrigation, more, sorry, more cultivation, and particularly once they adopted plows and so on, and plowed everything, and they had weed killers and everything else. The wind and water erosion was becoming really disastrous. You know, and so it water in particular, if there was a heavy rain, the lower slopes flooded. And that reminded me of when I was in Botswana doing my drought survey, right? Towards the end of my drought survey, because this was the worst, this is 1979, 80. It was the worst drought ever recorded in Botswana. Okay. Well, towards the end of that, the rainy season suddenly started. Been a year without rain, and now all of a sudden, and I was driving my Land Rover along roads which were basically rivers. Whole, like anybody who had any harvested sorghum or millet left in store, that those grain stores were washed away,
Wow.
added to the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was just a disaster. So when we look at the management of an ecosystem and we think subsistence, it's way more than just getting your food locally and not having commercialization. It also means that in the culture of the people in that society, there's an awareness of how to take measures to protect not just the plants, and the animals and grazing and all this, but also the hydrology of that ecosystem. And I think we're going to see that really, really significantly in the future as global warming kicks in. But anyway.
So you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I wanna like ask more specifically, what were the key differences between the hunter-gatherers in Botswana and the horticulturalists and nomadic pastoralists in Burkina Faso?
Well, I thought there'd be a lot more differences. Okay. I think I was assuming that if I, one of the reasons I agreed to the job and to go to West Africa was because I wanted to see the contrast. Okay. And so I was expecting, first of all, a much more hierarchical system of authority in these what we call post-Neolithic societies, in farming system and a pastoral livestock raising system. I was assuming, in a sense, the beginning of social stratification. Okay. And what amazed me was that, first of all, when I mapped out the village territories and the land use pattern in these village territories, and of course this is more true of the more traditional ones, up to 80% of the land was a commons, an area of what we call wild forest and wild animals. I saw chimpanzees, I saw elephants, okay. Particularly in that the southern village. And then so they were only using well, less than 20% of the village territory, because of course the village itself constituted a certain percentage, right? So the amount that was actually being used to produce food on a regular basis was actually quite small, and it was supplemented, significantly supplemented in the dry season by gathering wild plants and hunting wild animals in this large commons. Okay. So in a way, there was less difference in that land use pattern than I expected to see. I didn't expect that this large commons would be that big, even in less traditional villages. Okay. The other thing I found was the whole issue of political organization, because see, there goes one of my wolfhounds. The villages would have a chief, a village chief, and there would be kind of a council of elders, mostly consisting of the heads, the oldest heads of lineages within that village. There'd be 5, 10 lineages per village, lineage being a kinship group, okay, What I saw in West Africa were patrilineal lineages. Okay, patrilineages. Other places in the world have matrilineages, although that's not as common. And I thought this was a hierarchy of authority. So I went in with that mindset. And one of the first things I wanted to test for my employers was just how severe was the shortfall in terms of crop production. I mean, the whole point of Norman Borlaug said, the world is starving. We've got to do something to produce to prevent massive starvation, crop land deterioration, soil deterioration, all the rest of it. Soil fertility has to be restored, and he proposed using chemical fertilizers as well as improving the varieties that were being grown. Right, the whole thing. Okay, and I actually had the opportunity to speak with him once. He visited. Well, anyway, so that whole approach was based on the idea that these economic subsistence economies were inadequate. They weren't producing enough surplus, and so people were starving when there was a drought. People were in trouble with this traditional agriculture. So I thought, okay, so how bad is it? How can I measure this, right? And so the first thing I focused on were the grain storage containers. Okay, every household had a storage, a granary, often on a on interlocked tree branch, not tree, well, wooden scaffolding. And so I thought, oh, I'll measure that. That's the production from 1 year. Okay, that's where what that is. So I started out, but then as I walked around, I realized that these individual households also m said that if I wanted to really measure it, I should go to the lineage head, their lineage head. He said, because we give all our surplus to him. And I thought, oh my God. So this is confirming my idea about the authorities, right? Taking all the surplus. It sounded like a familiar pattern. So I went and measured their granaries instead, because that was the surplus. And that gave me a much better idea. If everybody else was basically just living from year to year, there was extra, but they had it. Okay. And then I found out from the lineage heads, after I was measuring their granaries, I found out that they every year gave a substantial amount of this surplus to the village chief. So I thought, aha, now this is how authority works to enrich the higher level, people. So I went through, and it was towards the end. It was, I think, the fourth or fifth village where I was doing this measuring and everything else. I was in becoming increasingly kind of cynical when I talked to these guys, you can imagine, right? And I'm measuring the depth of the surround and what's in there and everything. So at one point I asked, so, a grain is this? Like, I think he had seven or eight of these granaries. I just wondered, how long it took him to fill all this up. And he said, it's probably at least 6 years of harvest surpluses collected here. And I said, yeah. And I wrote that down. And then he absolutely stunned me. You know what he said next? He said, I think I finally have enough that even if we get a bad drought like happened 10 years ago, I think I can feed everyone in the village. Imagine. And of course, the lineage heads, when I finally got around to actually asking why they were storing what they had. For the lineage heads in particular, it wasn't to feed everybody in the village or even in the lineage. It was because they knew that there would be some members of their extended lineage who had a poor crop year because they broke their arm or because they got really sick. Malaria and so on was widespread. This kind of disease that caused the limbs to swell was widespread. Anyway, lots of possibilities for failure due to illness or accidents occurring to the household, you know. There were also cases where you know, there was a widow trying to raise a few children, and she couldn't produce enough. And so he would just, the lineage head would just move her into his compound, and she would be fed from these this surplus that everybody else was contributing. If there were people who got sick during the year, or their house, you know, their hut burned down, or their granary got invaded by some kind of noxious insect or something, you know, anybody who was in need, in other words, within that lineage, was looked after by the lineage head and fed, if not even housed often, by his larger compound with its large number of granaries. That was how the system was working. It meant that nobody went hungry. Nobody went without shelter. If there was a need for anyone to be helped in any way, it was found, you know? And the chief was chief. And it was, by the way, that most of the chiefs are actually elected. The council meets and discusses various candidates. They're not necessarily hereditary offices. On the basis of a lifetime of experience with that person, and it's based on the fact that that person had impressed everybody with diligence, integrity, honesty, generosity. All these qualities, right? And that's why they trusted this person to become village chief and to be the one to safeguard their long-term survival over drought periods and so on. Okay. Now imagine what happens when you start appealing to individual people. Even village chiefs are susceptible. You start appealing to various people with the idea that they can actually make money to buy things like motorcycles and stuff like that if they produce a certain number of cash crops, okay? And it can get away from them. You know, like the younger generation gets all excited about, you know, getting record players and radios and bicycles and carts and motorcycles and all this kind of stuff. And you know, they begin to see that there's a bigger world, and they want to go and get jobs, so they need to be educated, so they send their kids to school. All of that costs money, you know. So you see the beginning of the breakdown of a subsistence economy as it becomes hooked into a larger sort of state level kind of system. And that's what I was seeing in Burkina Faso. And had been going on for a long time since the colonial period, but it was also something that had happened periodically before, because some of the oldest empires that we know of are located in West Africa. You know, the Malian Empire, and you know, and the Fulani had a much higher level administration at one point. There was gold there. You know, there's all kinds of things. They've been the local rural people have, in a sense, been trying to safeguard their management of their local ecosystem against these pressures for thousands of years. And it's true all over the world. So when you talk about rewilding, right, what you're really talking about is giving the remaining indigenous rural people the right to not take part in the commercial world of civilization. And unless you can rupture that, there are always going to be people who want to sell their last forests or lead tourist expeditions or convert their farm into I don't know, a place where safaris can go or something like that.
Right.
And I don't think in our society that we have a clear idea at all of what we consider progress to be, because many people consider, Western civilization advanced.
Right.
And that, to me, that's a,
Yeah.
it's advanced how? Look what we are advancing towards. We're advancing towards an annihilation of millions of species of insects, of wild plants, of other animals. So many animals are endangered and so on.
So this raises my next question, which is, can you tell me the conflicting needs of a subsistence economy versus the needs of the nation state?
Well, the nation state,
Or just the
is
state? I don't
a,
know.
I know. Well, remember, I mean, most of the time, just remember the example of Ur, one of the earliest nations that we know of, city of Ur. It begins with the needs of people who don't produce their own food. And or other resources. Okay. So stuff has to be brought in. And it means that you, if you're running a nation state, you're supporting these urban areas. In the earliest one, it was just one urban area, but it rapidly grew beyond that. And you've got to safeguard against other nation states that might want to invade and take some of your resources because it becomes competitive, And at that point, you have to have armies, right? And that military aspect really gets heightened. I'm not saying that hunter-gatherers never engage in violence or fighting. They do occasionally, but they think it's stupid. That's
Yeah.
remember having a talk with a guy called Ragai, who became a really good friend in a way. He was a Bushman healer. I guess you'd call it a shaman, okay? And towards the end of my stay there, he said, you've been talking to us and questioning us for hours at a time about our way of life and our history and what we do. What about you? Where do you come from? What about your family? We've given you all our names of our parents and grandparents and siblings and everything. What about you? So I told him, well, my family comes from a part of Europe, and I had my father. I explained the family, and I said my father's older brother was studying to become a dentist, which is to look after people's teeth. And Ragai laughed at that. He thought that was ridiculous. But anyway, but he was killed in the Second World War. And my father also was in this war, and he managed to survive it. But he was so disgusted with, the way things had gone, and that he didn't want to be part of that country anymore. So he got sponsored. He was in a prisoner of war camp, by the way, in Lethbridge in Ontario, in Alberta. Anyway, so when he came back, he got sponsored to come back to Canada by one of the guards at the camp, right? So I told him more and more about all this. And then towards the end of this, Ragai said, so in a war, you send all the men away to go and fight other men who've also been sent away from their families? And I said, pretty much. At least that's what it was like in the war my dad was in. And he said, yep, yeah, but that's crazy. If you get killed, what's going to happen to your family? You know, he just couldn't, he, you know, to him, it just seems so. It's one thing if somebody attacks your camp, you have to fight back. But to deliberately send people away to go fight other people who've also been sent away from their family, why? You know, and what that illustrates is that in a way that the concept of creating an armed force to take over territory or else to defend territory from being taken over is a state level thing, I think. You know, it may happen to a lesser extent perhaps in tribal societies too, but it really becomes institutionalized in states. They tend to have what are called standing armies, right? And they often have compulsory military service and this kind of thing. And then a lot of that has to do with, you know, keeping control over a certain little part of the earth, right? They want to retain control. Well, why? Because now with the whole sort of neoliberalism, and that's not actually neoliberal, you know that, eh? That's actually neo-corporate.
Yes.
Corporations now have more control over how resources are distributed and moved around the planet and who can dig what and who can harvest what or whatever than governments do. You know, governments who try to restrict you know the movement of goods across borders are liable to be sued by the corporations that are doing the moving. You know, and that's as true of the automobile industry as it is of the oil industry. You know, I mean, when the was it Kinder Morgan was building this second pipeline for the heavy oil from Alberta across the mountain and across it's called the Trans Mountain Pipeline. The old one is almost 60 years old. So they were building a new one. They said it would increase the capacity, but I think they were also worried about increasing leaks and stuff in the old one, you know. But anyway, they were trying to build this, and there were a huge amount of protest from Indigenous people and local farmers about the process, okay, because of spills and all the rest of it. And finally, you know, since our federal government, the Alberta government wasn't interested in stopping it. So the federal government finally tried to step in and found that there was really nothing they could do. But as a way of solving some of the issue, they actually bought the pipeline from Kinder Morgan. Kinder Morgan used to be what's it called? Enbridge? I can't remember now.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Anyway, it was one of those Wall Street disaster companies. Anyway, so they bought it, and there was a huge tra-la-la about, oh, Trudeau is now supporting the oil industry. No, it's just that way, at least, if they do want to shut it down, it belongs to them. And in the meantime, you know, continuing to build it is really important to the corporations that are still persisting in mining the tar sands.
Right.
And so, you know, they kind of go along with that, partly because the old one is so old, it's dangerous. And until they can actually get somehow, you know, the populace to support the end of the oil industry, even the tar sands, it's political suicide to take direct action. So they're slowly building it. But if they do want to shut it down, they can do it. Plus, some of the costs of building it would, you know, hypothetically be repaid to the people of Canada as the but once the pipeline comes into use, if that ever happens. But what do you do when somebody like Kinder Morgan could sue your people, your federal government, for billions of dollars? if you try to stop the pipeline. And that's what NAFTA guarantees.
It's really weird. The whole, all of the.
Well, people didn't realize what all these so-called free trade agreements were all about. They really do is they free up the trade for corporations. They don't actually help people, except at the very top, you know?
So you mentioned that, rewilding means essentially protecting a lot of the people that are still practicing their
That's
subsistence
right.
economies. And I agree 100%. I also think there's, as a sort of movement, it's not just about protecting those people as much as it's also about engaging with subsistence economies and trying to figure out how to limit our consumption and limit our growth.
Well, also restoring ecologically viable
Absolutely.
species. I mean, returning beavers,
Totally.
returning wolves, returning bison
Yes.
to ecosystems. Like right now in Scandinavia, Norway and Sweden and so on, there is a lot of fighting going on with the Sami,
Right.
the reindeer herders, right? And that's a subsistence economy based on livestock, if you can call it that, that's semi-wild, all right? And I would suggest, probably a lot of people would pound on me for this, but I think probably the caribou in the boreal forest and the bison on the plains were similar to the reindeer in Lapland. They were semi-wild. In other words, they were being managed by the human populations that were associated with them, the plains people. And those people also recognized the importance of beavers in maintaining the hydrological health of
Totally.
systems, and the function of predators like wolves and cougars. Cougars and wolves are probably the only chance that we have for avoiding the spread of what's called it's a prion disease, chronic
In the
disease
deer.
in deer, okay? Because they prey selectively on those animals and they're not susceptible to the prion, okay? Humans are. I mean, this is what caused, what was it, the BSE cattle crisis, right?
Totally.
And so if the cougar and the wolf had not been eliminated throughout much of the United States and certainly much of southern Alberta, that disease wouldn't have got this far. And they are basically our only chance of avoiding the total destruction of the deer population in these areas. There's very few deer are going to be able to avoid getting that disease. It's a prion. It's not even a virus. Plus, get this, agriculture of various kinds, particularly deep plow agriculture, disrupts the ingredient, the elements within the soil, right? And it produces prions in
Interesting.
agriculture. Yeah, I can send you the
Huh.
papers on it.
Yeah, I would
It's
love
really
to see that.
scary. So prion diseases, which of course, when a human gets it, it's basically like fast forward dementia, right?
Right.
Plus you
Yeah.
stop being able to move, like you're it's death, the death sentence. Okay. And this is something that the government doesn't, they went through this whole thing where whole herds of cattle were slaughtered. Remember that in Western, yeah. But they're still promoting deer hunting, except here in Alberta now there's been a warning issued not to consume venison. But how many people have heard that? How many people are aware of how dangerous this is? Okay, particularly Indigenous people, and it's what if it spreads to the caribou, in the boreal forest? It could go anywhere. We need our predators. We need this whole ecosystem interacting. And that the fact that this ecosystem has sets of consequences that unfold over centuries is something that your short-term economics, year-to-year planning doesn't even consider. So we're in that kind of a situation now. And
So,
of course, the other thing we haven't discussed is the human population explosion.
yeah, I did a whole podcast on that one a couple of podcasts ago. I'm just my last question is, and then I'll also ask if you have any extra things you'd like to add that we didn't touch on. But my last question is, in what ways do you think it's possible for people to take up subsistence economies now or to return to them?
Well, there is definitely an interest in that. I would say gardening, like household gardening, if anybody has at least a plot of land, that's been going on for a long time. People like to produce their own vegetables and things like that in their own gardens if they can. Keeping chickens supply meat and eggs, you know, and that kind of thing can be done. Keeping rabbits, a couple of goats, as long as you're not trying to produce a commercialization of it, like where, you know, I get so discouraged when I see, you know, people trying to promote this kind of thing. You can get rich, you know, if you just plant enough cucumbers or whatever it is. You know, the idea that it's enough to produce a lot of your own vegetables and re-can your fruits from your raspberry patches or your apple trees or things like that. That's enough. You don't need to buy these things. In other words, if it's coupled with a retreat from the massive grocery store industry, okay? But I don't think we're going to quite get there until we, in a sense, deal with the dangers of what we call the military industrial complex.
Yes.
You know, because that is very dangerous, and we're seeing the consequences now. War is one of the most profitable businesses on the planet. I wish it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that the military industrial complex, or even what predated it in terms of larger scale states, or even the proto states, were essentially forcing people out of their subsistence economies. And that framework is still here. So in a sense, no matter what we do, if we don't get rid of the force that is forcing everybody to not be in a subsistence economy and to produce excess wealth for them, we can't really get out of that system. So yeah, that's a whole other, that's like the can of worms I'm going to move into in the next couple podcasts, I think, is like, yeah, how do we get out of that mess?
Well, listen, I think I just saw my husband's vehicle. So in a few minutes, I'm going to have to quit here, if that's okay. I
Yeah.
think.
Is there anything else you wanted to say before we sign off?
Well, only that next time I will try to wash and comb my hair.
It is what it is. Yeah, no.
I
Yeah,
know,
it's
but.
fine.
Yeah, no, I'm not really that. I mean, I'm 70 now or something, so it's just I wanted to inject a little humor. We need to keep our sense of humor to keep hope alive, if you will, that the human species, the vast majority of people, are basically good. They're basically very positive in terms of, you know, trying to interact. They'll help you if they can. And if we can just keep going and keep the word spreading that this system that we're in now is damaging not just the ecosystems of the planet, including the ocean ones, right? And that it's leading to climate change, which could be disastrous, not just for our species, but you know, the whole of Gaia. That message, I think, is getting across. There are lots of people who kind of know that, but they feel trapped. Like they need their jobs, you know. Here in Alberta, I know a lot of people who are farming commercially and growing canola and all this kind of stuff, and they need to be able to pay their taxes and pay their bills. One of my neighbors spends, he has like upward of, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 a year just on diesel fuel. It's like, what? How do you get out of that?
Yeah.
horrifying. And yet people got into it because there were markets, right?
Totally.
And one of the issues is the market economy, how do you disconnect that from individual lives? And it has to become optional again.
Totally.
Stop buying stuff if you can avoid it. Stop buying even food if you can avoid it. Grow your own, that kind of thing. And it, of course, a lot of people look down on that. Just like they look down on homeless people. But when I tell people that there are no homeless people in a tribal society, or even in a band level society among hunter gatherers, it's not even a concept that makes they're startled. They think somehow, if you're homeless, you deserve it somehow. And and maybe, that's kind of a garbled way to end this, but I haven't lost hope, because I think human nature is very loving, essentially. Most little kids are curious and loving and entranced by insects and beautiful things and other creatures. Ecology is endlessly fascinating to most people. If they haven't been sort of persuaded otherwise, the ecological whole aspect of eco warriors and so on. There are negative movements about that, unfortunately. But I'm convinced it's a minority. It's a minority of people that are still driving this destructive economy forward. And some of them are involved in making bombs and, tanks and stuff like that. And yet they're probably not bad people. They just need to make money, and they inherited these businesses or got jobs in these businesses. So it's not a matter of condemning other people. It's a matter of, creating another option. Anyway, on that note,
Awesome.
my husband's coming
Great.
home. I'm going crazy. You can see them all in the background. Well, that's been fun, and I hope that if we do this again, we won't have as much trouble
No
at work.
problem. Yeah,
Okay.
thank you so much for coming on the Rewilding Podcast. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Rewilding Podcast. Check out the show notes to connect with my guest and for a list of resources that we mentioned in our conversation. If this episode inspired you, made you think more deeply, or gave you some new tools to use, make sure to subscribe and become a patron at patreon.com/PeterMichaelBauer. If you're new to rewilding or want to expand your perception of it, I recommend attending one of my Rewilding one-on-one workshops, which I offer both in person in Portland, Oregon, and online for those who live around the world via Zoom. You can check upcoming dates and register at rewildportland.com. Thanks for listening.